Welcome. Time to settle in for some conversation on Juno Afternoon this Friday. I'm Rhonda McBride. Some big ideas to talk about today. Coming up, the cycle of homelessness and addiction. Not easy to break. How the Teal Center could be a game changer for Juno. And 75 miles south of here, a beacon of safety for more than 100 years. Will the Five Finger Lighthouse continue to light the way for the next generation? Also, how a Juno writer has turned her children's book into a short animated film just in time for Halloween. So what kind of weather can our trick-or-treaters expect? Well, looking pretty good after we get past tonight and tomorrow's cloudy skies and scattered rain showers, isolated snow showers later on tonight, lows in the mid-30s. Now, tomorrow, Eagle Crest might see some snow in the morning. Sunday and Monday, mostly clear. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Gonachshish for being here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride. 2021 will be remembered for things that changed our world forever. The pandemic that's forced masks upon us, social distancing, Zoom fatigue, just to name a few. But perhaps when we look back years from now, 2021 will also mark an important turning point in Juno's ongoing efforts to break the cycle of homelessness, addiction, and other problems for the most vulnerable members of our community. Next Tuesday, the Glory Hall celebrates the completion of its new shelter, and right next door, a groundbreaking for the Teal Center. Here with us now to talk about these two pivotal developments, Maria Lovischuk, Executive Director of the Glory Hall, and Joan O'Keefe, Executive Director of United Human Services. Maria, let's start with you because we haven't talked with you since this summer, and that was when the Glory Hall was just about to open. So how have things been going since then?
It's been pretty great. I really don't have another word for it, except for it's been really great. Our kitchen got completed at the end of August. In September, a lot of our volunteer groups came back and they're now cooking in the building. So we're having yummy dinners. We're having breakfast and lunch. People have really been reacting in a very positive way to the little sleeping spaces that people have where we can lock up their stuff and not lose it. Just the bigger building and the ability of people to be in their own space during the day has really decreased the amount of conflicts. Collaborations of partner agencies have increased tremendously. Search's Front Street Clinic comes out here twice a week now. We have Bartlett Regional Hospital navigators in our conference room because we have a room for them. We have offices where we're able to meet with people and like talk about goals and like talk about hard things. In privacy, we have a secured entry, so we actually know who is in our building. Since we've been opened, we've been able to get over 30 people into either affordable housing, permanent supportive housing, rehab facilities, or just home to their families where we wanted to go for a long time but haven't been able to go. So it's been really good, I think.
Can you share some stories about how people have responded to the new living situation and maybe compare to what it was like when you were cramped in that old building downtown?
Well, before we moved, like a couple of weeks before we moved, I just really worried. I was just wondering, like, did we make a really big mistake because we were moving to the Valley out of town and nobody was going to come? And the very second night, first day of our opening, we were completely full. Like every little room was full. People came. It's like it's been really nice to see. People just really seem to like palpably shed a little bit of stress, which was really great. And then just the whole idea that people were not going to leave downtown and, not get to the Valley, that did not materialize at all. People definitely got out to the Valley. And we had our shuttle going for a little bit. And then our driver got COVID, and so we discontinued the shuttle, but people still figure out how to get here using the public transportation. And we have a great program going where people can do some volunteer work and get a bus pass, which contributes to mobility and independence. So that's been really great.
Have people begun to transform? Can you see signs of that moving out of a place that just really didn't make anybody feel very secure or feel like it was home?
Well, we've had one gentleman. This was a multi-agency effort, but he's been experiencing homelessness in Juneau for 27 years, suffered the substance abuse for the majority of his life. He is 59 now. He wasn't allowed to come into the Old Glory Hall before because the space was so small, and he really had challenges being around other people in a safe way. In the New Glory Hall, he had his own little space, and so he was able to be here, and he was able to meet with us. And this last Friday, he got on the plane and went to Milwaukee into a 2-year rehabilitation facility. Like this space enabled him to like really get enough strength collected together, and like allowed us enough space to work with him to facilitate him getting there. And now he is in a treatment facility. And it's really just like thinking about the Old Glory Hall and being able to do that. Like there's just no way. There's no way that could have happened at all. And just generally, there's just a lot less stress and a lot less conflict happening here.
Well, it seems that many shelters and the Old Glory Hall kind of got caught in that cycle of helping people, but not being able to break the cycle that would eventually bring them back. And so this is part of a bigger campus. And I guess what next Tuesday, there's a celebration, and it's sort of a two-part celebration. So Joan, can you explain why it's a two-parter?
Sure. Thank you, Rhonda. It's a two-parter because we're going to celebrate the Glory Halls. They're open. It's sort of a community thank you that they want to share with the community. And it's the groundbreaking for the Teal Street Center, which will be a resource hub of many agencies, social service agencies under one roof, providing those services, important services to help our most vulnerable and our community members get a leg up. And we're really excited about the event next Tuesday.
The idea behind the Glory Hall, the new Glory Hall, is that it would be part of a campus, that it wouldn't be in isolation as it was downtown. And so the Teal Street Center, where's it going to go and what's in the campus now?
This is our groundbreaking next Tuesday. We've done some site prep, so it's a big empty lot right now, and it's located between the new Glory Hall and St. Vincent de Paul's facilities, their low-income senior housing, Smith Hall, and their transitional housing. They've got 24 units in the one facility and 26 in the other. On the other side will be the Glory Hall and their capacity to be able to sleep 58 folks over there.
So what is so important about this little piece of this campus?
First of all, it's really important what all of the organizations in the Teal Street Center, the future building, do already. It's critical. What's really important about it to the Glory Hall particularly is that most of our patrons do experience some kind of a disability. And it's really difficult for folks to get stabilized without having access to service, convenient access to services. And so to have Southwest Alaska Independent Living, and to have Alaska Legal Services, and to have the Disability Law Center be right next door so we can walk our patrons over, or we can walk over and get an appointment and not really have to, you know, get on the bus in the rain, you know, while they have mobility issues, like go somewhere, get lost, give up, like to just like have the services on the campus right there. It's going to be critical. I mean, it really is going to be a game changer for how we deliver services to people who need them most.
We have 8 permanent tenants. Their boards have committed 10 years, and SAIL and Alaska Legal Services, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Cancer Connection, Disability Law, NAMI Juno, and their Juno Suicide Prevention Coalition, the United Way, United Human Services will all be there. As of yesterday, we've added Central Council, Tlingit and Haida, Indian Tribes of Alaska. They are going to have a presence. They've made a commitment to the first floor. They're going to have a kiosk, a resource kiosk, and a navigator on the first floor. And as well, we have a a resource room because we could only fit so many agencies in the building. So we have this very innovative idea of a resource room that will have itinerant providers. And we've got a number of strategic partners that have committed to the resource room, 4A's for AIDS Prevention Services and CERC for Adult Education and the State of Alaska's Folk Rehab for Employment Services and Bartlett Hospital's Housing Navigator. They're all going to be tenants, provide services on a rotating basis. And then, as Maria mentioned earlier, Front Street Clinic Search will have their mobile medicine van offering behavioral health and basic medical on the campus from the parking lot. So we're just so thrilled to have all these services at the campus. And, you know, we did community forums to see what agencies made sense, what partners and resources would make the most improvement to outcomes. And that's how we came up with who we have there. Hopefully I named all the agencies there that'll be part of our project.
And also because of this campus, Search's Front Street Clinic is able to come out because there's now a spot for them to come see us. That's a really key partner for the Glory Hole, especially. Just so important to get those primary care services for our folks.
So what was the inspiration for creating this social service hub right next to the housing?
Joan, I think, has been at it for a really long time, but I'll just say that, you know, seeing how nice it was at the Housing First facility to have services on site for folks that really needed them made it abundantly clear to me, but it was obviously very clear to other people.
One of our permanent tenants is the United Way of Southeast Alaska. And, you know, they've got board minutes that they started talking about this back in 2002, almost 20 years ago. It's been bubbling in our community ever since. We commissioned demand studies from McDowell Group, which is now McKinley Research. We've worked with the Nonprofit Center Network, which is a national and international consulting group. There's actually hundreds of nonprofit centers around the country. So we did our best to learn from the model. And, you know, there's a bunch of research out there that says that it's a best practice to put strategic resources at the heart of high need population. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Well, it seems like a lot of times when services are scattered all over a community that people never make it to that next referral.
That's definitely true. And it's just also like, it's a lot to expect of somebody in crisis. When we were imagining the new Glory Hole coming together, one of the things we really wanted to do is we really wanted to minimize crisis and definitely, at the very least, have a facility and have a program that does not add to somebody's crisis, like an intensified, but does the opposite, diminish the crisis. And so President Peterson said this.
President Richard Peterson, right, with Tlingit Haida?
Yes, when we were talking about concepts and programs, you know, just it's really good to lift people up. And that just really stuck with me for a while. Like, we want this service that helps people to stabilize and lifts people up. And I think bringing services to people, as opposed to having people go chasing services spread out all over town in our weather, does exactly that. Like, it definitely gives people an opportunity to stabilize.
Well, with so many issues that people who struggle with homelessness have, there's no Band-Aid. There's no one thing that helps somebody. I imagine that all of your residents in those different facilities all have different issues, different needs, and it's probably impossible to consolidate everything that's needed in one specific facility.
I definitely agree, but I think it's just really cool, just kind of like what Joan was saying, you know, just having the space, like having a conference room and having a resource room. You know, for example, since we've been here, the Tlingit and Haida Regional Housing Authority has this really amazing program for veterans. They have vouchers for both Native and non-Native veterans. This really amazing person coordinates that program here in Juneau and in Southeast, and she's been coming here. And she has a space now to meet with the veterans. And a lot of the veterans who did not used to stay with us because staying in our downtown shelter in the dorm rooms, it really intensifies somebody's PTSD, are now staying here because they can have their own little individual spaces. the Veterans Administration has been able to come here, has been able to work with people on their applications. People, you know, can keep track of their documents, so the application process goes faster. Since we've been here, she's housed 3 veterans already, just since the end of July, beginning of August, and she's working with 2 more right now, and they're imminently going to get housing. They're going to get their own apartments for the first time in a really long time. So can't fit all the services in this 2 buildings, but you can definitely have people come visit.
But definitely, instead of having people scattered and trying to put services in every building, this seems to make a lot more sense, Joan, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Both for folks needing services and to help strengthen the agencies that are providing the services. We'll be offering below market rents so that the tenants can spend more of their valuable resources on mission, on providing those services. We're trying to impact both sides of the coin.
So I have to ask this, Joan, are you needing funds to finish this new Teal Center, or is that money already out there and provided?
Great question. It's about a $6.5 million project. We are just shy of 70% of the way there now. We've broken the construction up into 2 phases, and we have the funds secured for phase 2. So we're moving ahead. We've got quite a few grants and proposals out there, and we've got a very active capital campaign committee out there raising more funds. But yes, we are continuing to raise that last 30%.
What do you think, Maria? Is that a really good investment that will see bigger returns than that chunk of money?
We are going to see returns from a chunk of money for decades and decades and decades to come. And immediately, we're going to see an immediate return. So people should definitely donate to the Teal Street Center right now. It will make it a lot faster for the Teal Street Center to complete construction in time if they have the funding. And I have no doubt that it's going to be completed and successful. It's the greatest project. The 100 Women Who Care just chose the Teal Street Center as the object of their giving this quarter. And I've been so happy to write that check. It was just great.
Didn't they give money recently to the Glory Hall?
That's when I became 100 Women Who Care. I didn't really understand it that much. And then the Glory Hall, and I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. So I joined.
Yeah, it's 100 women who give a certain amount of money, but it's actually more than 100 women now who collectively give this little pot of money, and it's money that's targeted. It can make a big difference. So in wrapping things up, you will have your celebration and your groundbreaking for the new Teal Center. So what emotions are you going to be feeling next Tuesday?
I'm going to be feeling really stressed out because we have a big pile of construction materials that we got to clean up before Tuesday, which we will.
Maria, I have seen you over the years at various times at the Glory Hall with piles of stuff around you and all kinds of people needing things all at once and not having even enough staff to sort things out. So what is it going to be like for you on Tuesday just to take pause and think about how far you've come?
Yeah, well, I hope not to cry. Since we opened, I'm just feeling this overwhelming sense of gratitude to the community. So I'm pretty sure that I will feel that. And also just quite honestly, a sense of relief. It is a great relief to be done with this project, a sense of anticipation, waiting for Joan's project to come online, and just excitement. I mean, this is a really exciting and hopeful time.
Joan, what are you going to be feeling?
Well, I'm going to be feeling gratitude. We've had so many donors and community members helping with our project. So I will be feeling gratitude as well as resolve until this project is over the finish line.
So Tuesday, November 2nd from 11 to noon. And you have to sign in for this, right?
If people want a tour of the Glory Hall, it is kind of important to RSVP because of COVID restrictions. So if folks could RSVP, that would be really helpful.
Yes, we are asking people to mask up and social distance and all that. We want to have a safe celebration, of course.
Long time in coming, huh, Joan? How long for you?
Gosh, I have been with this effort for, 15 years probably.
Well, I guess that gives us hope, right? That if you try long enough and hard enough, you can make something happen.
Don't give up.
Well, I just want to thank you very much, Maria Lovechuk and Joan O'Keefe. Thanks so much. And we're looking forward to your celebration on Tuesday.
Thank you very much, Rhonda.
Coming up, the next best thing to being there, our next guest paint a picture for us of the iconic Five Finger Lighthouse. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. This is Rhonda McBride. Thanks for being here with us today as we take you to the Five Finger Lighthouse, which sits on a rocky outcrop 75 miles south of Juno and 45 miles north of Petersburg. Well, there's no place like it anywhere, a beacon of safety since 1902, and now in need of protection itself from the ravages of time. Jeff Erickson and Oren Pearson are members of the Five Finger Lighthouse Society, here to tell us about efforts to raise money for the lighthouse. Well, Jeff, the lighthouse is in so many ways iconic, but can you set the scene for us? Give us an appreciation of just how special this place is.
The Five Finger Lighthouse sits on a remote island, and it's a very hard to access the island because it's built on a rock, and its steep sides prevent people coming on the island when it's rough out. So really the only time you can get there is when the weather is really ideal.
Was that a very treacherous area for boats?
Yeah, and it is. And it started in 1902, and it was right around the time that gold was discovered, and there was more and more shipping. The powers to be had chosen this place to put a light, and it's seen from all different directions, up to 18 miles away. It's still used today as a beacon for navigation.
Can you describe, Oren, what I would see if I were approaching it by boat?
Yeah, it's out in the deep part of Frederick Sound, and it's one of a couple of really small islands, the Five Finger Islands. If you were flying overhead, if you were a bird, and if the tide was low, you would see these islands almost shaped like the bony hand of a skeleton reaching out from the deep part of Frederick Sound. On the biggest of those bony little islands, or on the southernmost rather, you would be greeted by a lighthouse, a white lighthouse made out of concrete in a Art Deco style. It's a style unique to Alaska, because Five Finger Lighthouse is the oldest lighthouse in Alaska. It burned down in the extreme winter of 1933 and then was rebuilt thanks to New Deal and the Public Works Administration. And that's why it has this concrete construction in this Art Deco style, a style unique to Alaska, and a style that you see in a few other lighthouses around the state as well. Behind this white spike of concrete with a nice gleaming cupola at the top, you'd see some tall spruce trees that have grown on this little spike of granite. Basically, it's the summit of a big underwater mountain, and it's just the granite summit that pokes out, and the lighthouse is built over the top of it. Spruce trees, their trunks and roots wrap over the top of the jagged granite summit. That's all there is on there, just birds flying around. There's no mammals except, like me, this summer when I volunteered as the lighthouse keeper, as the only mammal living on the island. But marine mammals all around, whales, seals, otter, sea lions, orcas, cruising around. But it's a strange place.
What did you feel when you stayed there? What an amazing opportunity.
Yeah. I felt grateful mostly. It's so quiet out there too. You know, we had some some crummy weather this summer, which was an amazing and strange opportunity to be out there. As Jeff mentioned, visitors can really only reach the lighthouse when it's flat, calm, really. But I was fortunate to be out there in rough weather, the wind shaking all the trees and feeling the building groan under the weight of it, and just the thunderous crashing of waves onto the rocks on the island. And then the silence when those calm down, and the sound of humpback whales snoring underwater. And it's a mystifying place. Sunset in every direction and sunrise and those glory beams coming out of the clouds over every little island. It is the most beautiful place I've ever been.
I have heard of people being able to stay out there, aside from being the lighthouse keeper like Oren was. Are there other opportunities to spend the night there and kind of have that same mystical experience?
Yeah, so right now, if you're a board member or have a membership in our society, you can go out to the island. We need to have a lighthouse keeper out there. Mainly our infrastructure is in need of repairs. The electrical is what we're working on right now. And we're actually doing a fundraiser to raise money to get a new battery bank. And those battery banks are quite expensive. I mean, we're talking $18,000 to $20,000, but it would really enhance the ability to have people living out there. So I just want to mention, too, that Jennifer Klein and Ed McIntosh were of Juno, were instrumental in 1997 to make this a reality, taking it from the Coast Guard's hands and making it privately owned 501c3 partnership with people in Juno. Their main goal was to make it a bed and breakfast, and did outstanding work for preserving the island's history and preserving the buildings. And went a long ways to getting grants to make it available for people to spend the night. And then upon their deaths, 2017 and 2019, we've taken over in Petersburg. We've got a group of about 6 board members, and I think we're over 60 people now, membership. And we're striving to maintain a working lighthouse, you know, quite expensive. We can only reach it really from beginning of May until the end of September. In the winter months, it's almost impossible to get there.
So long ago and far away, who was the lighthouse keeper in those winter months? Did they just stay the whole winter?
Oh, yeah. So this was the first lighthouse built in Alaska. And for the first 39, I guess, years of its existence, it was a government agency called the U.S. Lighthouse Service, and it would be a lighthouse keeper and 2 assistant keepers, and they would just live there for years, years and years. I think one guy lived there, it might have been like 15 years. And then in 1939, the Coast Guard took over all the lighthouses in the United States, and it would be a crew of 6 Coast Guard service members staying 365-day stretches out at the lighthouse, and that was until 1984. So from 84 to 97, it was just empty. And that's why it took so much manpower and organizing and fundraising and volunteers to bring it up to a condition where it had the prospect of surviving into the future, but also accommodating visitors.
Jeff, it sounds like the lighthouse still needs a lot of TLC and $18,000 for the electrical system. How can we help? What can we do if we want to keep this iconic lighthouse alive for future generations?
Well, right now we are in the midst of a online art auction, and we asked some local artists to make some paintings and some other artsy stuff that they donated to the lighthouse. And we were going to have a in-person auction, and then we decided not to do that during this time of COVID. All the art is displayed online at the Five Finger Lighthouse Society Bidding Owl. It's going to go through October 31st, and you can get online and view the art and make a bid on it. And the artists have put out some really cool stuff. It's really nice to see it in person, but I think you can see what's going on online. And that's what we're doing now. Anytime you want to be a member, you can get on our web page and sign up to become a member. And then you can also sign up to come out and do some volunteer work in the summer. And you can contact us and we can work you into a work party. And that gives you an opportunity to come out to the lighthouse, check out all the cool stuff that's out there, and also do a little bit of work. If you get a chance to get out there, you instantly fall in love with the place. And most people say, what can I do to spend more time out here? So if you're lucky enough to get out there on a good day, I think you'll be hooked.
All righty. And what is that web address so everybody knows exactly where to go immediately after they hear this interview?
Go to the Lighthouse's website, fivefingerlighthouse.com. You'll find the form to become a member and make a donation to the Lighthouse. You'll find links to the online art auction, which is one of those bidding owl auctions, but you can find it from the website, fivefingerlighthouse.com. Check out the art. There's over 40 beautiful artworks, and it's the first big fundraiser for the Five Finger Lighthouse Society. And any contribution through membership or bidding on some of this great art makes all the difference in the world for creating a future for this beautiful lighthouse.
Well, there's not much time left to the end of the month to make your bid, but I guess people can always join at any time. I want to thank you, Jeff Erickson, a board member with the Five Finger Lighthouse Association, and Oren Pearson, who's a volunteer and was also a lighthouse keeper. Thanks very much for being here with us today. And also, good luck with your fundraiser.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Thanks, Rhonda. Appreciate your help.
Up next, a change of scenery from the beauty of nature to the spookiness of Halloween. How one Juno writer's children's book has been turned into a short animated film.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Depending on the genre of the book, she goes by either Lindy Miller or Lindy Ryan. Ryan for her horror stories, Miller for her romance novels. So for now, we'll just call her Lindy. She followed her husband to Juno when the Coast Guard transferred him here, but she's as busy as ever. She's out with a new animated film based on a children's picture book that she's writing, Trick or Treat, Aleister Gray, just in time for Halloween.
On a dark, crisp night, in the last days of fall, little Aleister Gray went to a Halloween ball. He stalked through the leaves, spun up in old rags, a homemade mummy with a trick-or-treat bag. When he arrived at the ball, Allie threw wide the doors, eager to see goblins and ghouls and werewolves on all fours. The room was trimmed for a Halloween caper, decked with hay bales and fat pumpkins and bats of great paper. A troop of bent witches circled the room, wearing green wigs and warts, holding twig-bristled brooms.
So, Lindy Miller, Lindy Ryan, I just never know which name is going to be attached to what seems like a split personality, Lindy the horror story writer or Lindy the romance writer. But either case, it's good to have you here today. And I guess we have the Lindy Ryan hat on today, right?
We do. The Lindy Ryan hat is on. Thank you for having me.
So Lindy Ryan is the horror story writer, and you have a book coming out next August, Trick or Treat, Aleister Gray. But we heard an excerpt from an animated film that's just been released based on the book. So it kind of comes just in time for Halloween. So maybe you should backtrack and tell us a little bit about who is Aleister Gray.
So Aleister Gray is a little boy who loves Halloween. But when he attends a school Halloween carnival, he's disappointed to see that the celebration is more silly than spooky, which is very much based on myself and my son, who I originally wrote the story for when he was just a little guy. But Aleister goes to his carnival. He's a little frustrated by the silliness and the lack of spook. And he goes on to meet a special Halloween friend that teaches him that there's more than one way to celebrate Halloween and shares some of the basis for, you know, the ancient traditions of the holiday.
So you have just produced an animated film based on this children's picture book. So how long is it?
The animated short is just a little shy of 10 minutes. So it's slow paced. It's intended to, you know, let little ones watch as they read along with the story and really get that full kind of cinematic experience, but follow along with the picture book.
Who does the artwork for your picture book?
So all the artwork was done by a Hungarian artist named Tamia Gazdag. I met her through a friend of a friend of a friend, you know, how these things always happen in creative circles. And I just fell in love with the way she drew characters and the way that she sparked them with life and personality, and her style is very reminiscent of, you know, maybe Tim Burton, Lemony Snicket, those types of kind of spooky but not scary children's Halloween projects. And we were able to work together on all 32 pages of the picture book. And I think that she did an absolutely phenomenal job that really encapsulates, you know, the ambiance and the kind of creepiness of Halloween into the illustrations.
Well, it's narrated by Sam Sheeran, and so you did a great job of reading us an excerpt from your book, but boy, he gives it a whole new feel, doesn't he, that story?
Oh my gosh, yes. I think, you know, Sam and I have been friends for quite some time, and it was such an honor to be able to collaborate and work together on this project. I mean, he is a British horror artist over in the UK and has done so much incredible work. He's well known for his creations over there. But what I was looking for when we decided to do this short was someone who really brought the spirit of the season into The Voice and could read Alistair and could read The Sentinel, his spooky Halloween friend, with all of the flair of a Vincent Price or a Christopher Lee. And I think Sam absolutely nailed that. There was no one else who could have brought that same voice to the book.
Let's hear a little bit more of Sam, Sharon. What part would you like us to hear?
I think one of the most interesting and exciting parts of the story is when Alistair actually meets the Sentinel, and you know, he's confronted with this kind of monstrous creature who speaks to him, you know, very friendly and very cheerfully. And so I think that's a great opportunity to hear Sam read the story, but also play the role of both the Sentinel and of Alistair.
All right, well, let's listen.
Then, without moving, the Sentinel grinned, a grin most unpleasant, and Alistair shivered in its unearthly presence. He looked deep into the Sentinel's strange glowing eyes, but was relieved to see it, despite his surprise.
"Thank you,"
he whispered.
"Thank you for coming. I don't understand what Halloween is becoming. It's all treats and no tricks, just candy and games. Where are the monsters, the rattling chains?"
The Sentinel's head gave a big wobbling shake, and this time spoke low with a voice like a snake.
"All Hallows' Eve is not just for the dark. It is something more sacred, in which fun is a part. This time of year is a festival of light, both for those still living and those haunting the night. Halloween is for us, when for just once a year we may come back to play with what once we held dear. It is wise to remember that night follows day, and we must live fully what we've been given to play. Then there's no reason to fear when the dark comes to call, when Halloween comes knocking, when it comes for us all. So take care, little mummy."
It's just very interesting these days as a writer that a video or an animated film precedes the book.
Yeah, this one is a little unique. Usually it's the other way around, you know, and most of my other projects, especially in the Lindy Miller side, are book to film process projects versus on the horror side, they somehow go the other direction. But what that has done for us in this situation is allow us to take the short film into a festival circuit and be able to show it at film festivals, especially the Halloween film festivals that are happening right now, and some of the festivals that are geared specifically to animated shorts. So we're able to go and do and maybe pick up some awards or get some early audiences, early press.
Wow. So you are using this film to create buzz for your book, to kind of pre-market it in some ways.
Yeah, that kind of, again, that kind of happened strangely. The book was supposed to come out before the film and even picked up a couple of awards and then the pre-publication process, but the film just picked up, moved a little faster, stars aligned and timing worked out. And we were able to get it up and get it together and hit the film circuit this year before the big release in time for Halloween next year.
Well, you always picture writers as people who have a hard time making ends meet, that, you know, they have to have a day job, that it's hard to be a full-time writer. But here you are in Juneau, I guess, after your husband transferred here with the Coast Guard, and you're making films, writing books constantly. How are you juggling that from Juneau?
Well, a lot of juggling. That's certainly true. We moved here, but we've been here about 2 years in Juneau, and I'm a professor by trade. So I still teach for Rutgers University. I still teach online, which is really nice today. It's very flexible and easy. I think I definitely write and work in the publishing entertainment space more than teaching. Luckily, you know, all of the people that I work with, whether it's my agents or fellow producers or editors, we're scattered all across the world. So it doesn't matter where we are, we always find a way to get together and work together and occasionally see each other at, you know, book events or, you know, film premieres or something like that. It's actually really nice to be hidden away and tucked in Alaska where no one can easily find me here in Juneau. And I get a lot of work done.
The last time that we talked to you on Juneau Afternoon, you told us about your new book that had come out, a romance novel set in Hawaii that has already been turned to a film and it's still apparently awaiting a venue. How is it that you're able to do all these different things with your work?
That's a question I get asked fairly often, as you might imagine, toggling between the romance side and the horror side. I jump back and forth between sweet seasonal stuff and dark, gritty, spooky stuff, and even quite a bit of nonfiction and poetry these days. So I always have something in progress, several other things lined up behind it. And yeah, but there's definitely common themes in all my work. And even Halloween is one of those common themes. Aside from Trick or Treat, Alistair Gray, which is a children's Halloween picture book. Last year, I released The Magic Ingredient, which is a sweet seasonal romance that takes place at Halloween. And is also optioned for film by the same producers of Aloha with Love. So I think what joined a lot of my projects together are the places and the themes within them and not necessarily the genre.
So Lindy Miller, not Lindy Ryan, wrote Magic Ingredient.
Lindy Miller. Yeah, it's my Dr. Jekyll, Mrs. Hyde side. The sweet stuff all gets Lindy Miller, which is my maiden name. And then all the spooky stuff gets, you know, Lindy Ryan and the nonfiction and a lot of good stuff stays under my married name.
So what is the plot in a nutshell for Magic Ingredient?
The Magic Ingredient is a story about a widower single father who is ready to start life over with his daughter, Candace. They move to Bar Harbor, Maine, which I grew up, spent some time growing up in Bar Harbor. And once there, they fall in love, not with just the community and the town and the island, but also with the owner of dessert shop and tea patisserie named Eve Silver, who's struggling to keep her family business alive. So it's a second chances story, both for Eve, for Jeff, and even for Candace, the daughter, as well as an entire universe to sink your teeth into with all the fun people and characters running around Bar Harbor, Maine.
So going back to your children's story that you put together on Alistair, who is based on your son, it's very interesting that Alistair doesn't think Halloween is scary enough as people celebrate Halloween these days, that he thinks it's devolved into silliness. What is it about Halloween that kids tend to crave being scared? Or maybe we all want to be scared.
I think we all want to be scared, even just a little. Nothing makes you feel more alive and more energized than a little bit of terror every now and again. And both my husband and I have really strong family heritages in Ireland, the Celtic Islands. And so we've grown up both celebrating those kind of older traditions of Halloween and really treating the holiday like a sacred moment. You know, we carve jack-o'-lanterns, we leave out bread for the dead. We set out candy for trick-or-treaters. We keep the lights ablaze for the night. And we honor those traditions in our house. And, you know, when my son was little, he says, you know, why do we do all these spooky things and, you know, always have spooky costumes and homemade costumes. But a lot of my friends are running around dressed up like superheroes and cowboys. And why am I not a cowboy? Why am I a ghost or a mummy? Actually, Alistair Gray wears a homemade mummy costume, which was one of my favorite ones that I made for my son when he was about 4.
What is it, Lindy, about Halloween being this holiday that is both spooky and scary and somewhat terrifying versus being fun and everybody letting go and sort of mocking death and the underworld of spirits.
Yeah, well, it's definitely both, right? And that's just what Alistair learns in the story, is that there's more than one way to celebrate. And everyone is celebrating, the living and the dead, right? We're honoring those who have come before us. We're partying with them as if it was, you know, a night for them to come back and join us. So it is a lot of fun. Bobbing for apples, trick-or-treating. We do pumpkin bowling in my house. A lot of fun in games. But it's also, you know, a little spooky talking about what happens after death. We're talking about people who've gone before us. We're talking about spirits returning and monsters and ghouls and all these, you know, super spooky things. So it's definitely, I think, a little of both, of fun and fright.
Fun and fright. Well, we'll leave it on that note. And thank you so much, Lindy Miller / Lindy Ryan, a split personality on our show. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Hope you have a fun Halloween.
You too, trick or treat.
Halloween, he reflected, is a time of joy and of fright. It's both, he decided, because it all honors the night.
The sentinel nodded, blinking its wide pumpkin eyes, and the time had now come to say their goodbyes. Tightening his rags, Alistair picked up his sack, when he heard from behind a sharp snap and a crack. The sentinel had gone, faded back into night. But still his voice lingered.
Trick or treat and sleep tight.
Quick program note for Juno Afternoon. Starting next week, some changes to tell you about. We have always had a second airing of Juno Afternoon at 4 o'clock on KRNN, but instead, we're moving the rebroadcast of the show to 7 o'clock at night on KTOO. National Native News is also moving to a new time slot. We'll tell you more about these changes on the show next week.
Support for Juno Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klingit and Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
And that'll do it for Juno Afternoon, which is a production of the KTOO Arts and Culture team, which includes Shelley Delaney, KXLL's Chandra Boom, and the leader of our team, Cheryl Snyder. I'm Rhonda McBride, your host for today. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. To listen to our interviews, see links to anything we've talked about here, or to be on the show yourself, check out our website, ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Well, until next time, thanks for joining the conversation. From all of us at KTOO, Gunnach Sheesh. Have a good evening and a safe and fun Halloween.